Bold and raw perspectives of local politics. Important information which impacts our community, nation, and world. Exposing truth, transparency, and getting to the heart of relevant issues that you just won't see in the clickbait media. And always keeping it real. It's the Michelle Tanner Podcast.
But I won't back down.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Michelle Tanner Podcast. Miss y'all last week, but this week is awesome. I'm making up for it with two awesome episodes. Today, I have with me Sheriff Nate Brooksby.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
I just want to say I really appreciate, any platform, whether it's a radio show or podcast or a town hall. I just really appreciate an opportunity to get to kind of let the community know what the sheriff's office is all about.
Yeah, and it's so important. I didn't even realize the power and authority and the importance of the sheriff's office until 2020. Yeah. And we started seeing sheriffs around the country standing up and saying, no, Governor, not in our county, right? Yeah. And so that was the first. Did you see the documentary called The Sheriff?
I didn't see that one. Was that Sheriff Mack by chance?
It was not. I don't think that one was specifically Sheriff Mack, but it was, just highlighting sheriffs during COVID in states. I mean, thankfully, we weren't as restrictive here in Washington County to where you had to make such a bold stance. But that was a real eye-opener of, wow, we need a constitutional sheriff, somebody who truly understands their role. And I think you are that person.
No, thank you. Well, absolutely. So just some history of the sheriff's office. So it is office, not department, because we're elected. You'd never say the Washington County Attorney Department, just like, it's kind of like nails on a chalkboard when I hear sheriff's department, because it is elected. So that is important. So nationally, the sheriffs are the only elected law enforcement position. So that's real powerful. So the chiefs of police, I get along great with all of our local chiefs. But the reality is they're appointed by the city council and the mayors. We were just talking off camera here a little bit, but at the end of the day, the buck stops with me in the office. So I get to make those hard decisions. I get to influence policy, and some other government entities don't necessarily have that luxury. So during my campaign, just leading up to 2021, I had a lot of citizens come and ask me, are you a constitutional sheriff? Well, absolutely I am. My Second Amendment right, due process, freedom of speech, religion, right to peaceful protest. But at that time, I did some research and come to find out that the state of Utah doesn't actually list the office of the sheriff in the state constitution. So when I came in, I started working with the Sheriff's Association and started talking to some of our legislators, pointing out that there are 33 other states that specifically list the office of the sheriff in their state constitution. And so we got enough buzz around that in last year's session, there was a bill that was ran in the House and Senate, and it passed unanimously.
Awesome.
So what that does, since it's a constitutional change, Utah requires that to be on the ballot. So even though it passed unanimously last year, this November, that will actually be on the ballot. So it'll simply say each county shall have an elected sheriff, period. So.
And amen. Why wouldn't we vote for that? Why wouldn't we want that? I mean, the last thing I would want is someone appointing a sheriff.
Correct.
Because there's less accountability there to we the people, right? If it's appointed versus if we actually get a vote.
Absolutely. What it does is if it was appointed, it would centralize power. So. Right. There has been, unfortunately, a little bit of chatter that there are some individuals that like to see the Attorney General's office appointed by the governor, and I think that puts too much power under one roof.
Absolutely, so, yes. Terrible idea.
To have specific elected officials, so we have a total of 9 in Washington County.
Don't try to cut us off already, Sean.
am I that bad? Come on. No, it's important to have the elected positions directly accountable to the people, so those individuals can think independently and don't have a board or a body that are steering them and how they operate on a day-to-day basis.
Right. So. Awesome. So one hot topic, obviously, in our country right now, especially over these last 4 years, is border security and illegal immigration. And here in Utah, we have not been immune from that. So I'm hoping that you can help clarify some of these things, because there's a lot of information out there right now about, is Utah a sanctuary state? How are we handling illegal immigration? Just to kind of recap, I think it was about a year ago that ICE came out with that memo that they actually then retracted. But essentially, the memo said that Utah is a sanctuary state. And then the governor and a bunch of legislators came out and said, no, we are not a sanctuary state. And I think the sheriff's office even made a statement as well. And so kind of the way I look at it, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong or with your perspective, but my perspective of it is, we may not be a sanctuary state in terms of actual designation, but in terms of some of our policies, we have made it a hospitable place in some ways, where we were one of the first states to pass to allow driver's cards for illegal immigrants. We actually passed a bill at the state legislature not too long ago that provides free health insurance for some of our illegal immigrants. They recently passed increasing E-Verify from 15 employees to 150 employees. So there are some things in terms of policy that I think has made it easier for illegal immigrants to be here. But what does that actually mean in terms of ICE, in terms of detainment? Are you seeing a big influx in your position in illegal immigrants? And what do we actually do with them?
Okay. I'll give you some history on this. So the three bills that you just talked about, the E-Verify, so it went from 15. So if you're an employer and you have, it was 15, and they moved that to 150 in 2021. So that's a policy change that I think it doesn't set well. Like any policy we have that attracts illegal immigrants to come in our country. And again, we're talking illegal. I'm all about legal immigration and finding a way to maybe expedite some of those processes. But we have to be a country of law and order. And without that, then we're going to fall apart. So I've already talked, as a matter of fact, just yesterday, I was talking to a couple of our local representatives that to look at the E-Verify statute, to look at the SNAP benefits for the medical for the children of illegals. And then, so I've already, I disagree with some of those policies, but to put it lightly, Utah is not a sanctuary state. It's not. So for years and years, the sheriff's offices, we run the jails. So out of 29 counties in the state, there's 27 that actually have jails. A couple smaller counties don't have them. But we worked almost my entire career with ICE, where we had long-term contracts with them, and we would house, 40 or 50 of their inmates. And it worked well for years and years. And then with the recent administration change, 3 years ago, our local ICE agents went from having a lot of work to do to waking up and having almost nothing to do. So that's a federal government policy change that's affected it. One of the key indicators of a sanctuary city or state would be policies that say that local law enforcement is not allowed to work with ICE. That's not the case in Utah. I work with ICE every single day. They're booking individuals in our jail on a daily basis.
So we are booking illegal immigrants into our jail.
Correct. The difference is, with the change in the federal administration, they all of a sudden created non-government entities, so NGOs that came in and did inspections in the county jails. So, and the rules changed. So we went from pretty simple inspections to 750 pages of rules.
Jeez.
To include special lotion lines. They had to have their own entrance.
Wow.
We couldn't lock their inmates down without calling and getting their permission first. So if I have inmates fighting in the jail, to keep order in the jail, I have to be able to separate them and put them in a lockdown cell until we can get things settled out. So the new rules basically made it impractical for us to be able to comply, and it left us subject to civil litigation. One big indicator is, it is an actual crime to cross into the United States illegally. It's a misdemeanor. The U.S. Attorney's Office doesn't charge that. So what they end up doing is putting the individual on a civil detainer. Well, I house criminals. So if they're saying I'm putting this individual in on a civil detainer, there's some legality issues there. Like, okay, they haven't been convicted of a crime. They're not being held on an actual crime. It's a civil detainer. So that's step one. That puts me in a bad spot. That puts me in a civil liability where, you know, groups like ACLU, they're going to see that and they're going to come after me. Or if I did, so the difference is the long-term contract. So about a year ago when that memo came out, Washington County and Salt Lake County were the only counties that were still dealing with ICE on the long-term contracts. So, and we had worked with them. We jumped through their hoops. We'd gone through their inspections. And then it went south pretty fast when we got dinged on an inspection on just ridiculous stuff. So these non-government entities are sharpening their pencils and they are looking for anything and everything to ding you on. So then if we fail an inspection, that, again, leaves us up to civil liability. Oh, well, you know, you didn't do this, this, and this, so we're going to sue you because you're not abiding by the rules.
But what if they actually committed a crime outside of the crime of being here illegally? I mean, what if this is a hard criminal who, say, raped someone, but they happen to be here illegally? Are you still saying that you are having liabilities for detaining them?
No. So if there's state charges, then 100%. So whether if you were charged with rape, whether you're illegal or illegal, you're going to go to jail. You're likely going to stay in jail for a long time until your case is adjudicated. And if you're found guilty, you're going to go to prison like anybody else.
Okay.
So that's still happening. So right now, ICE can bring anybody in. If local law enforcement arrests somebody on a state charge, ICE will screen that and may or may not put a detainer on them. So right now, because of ICE's rules, they can only keep in my facility for 48 hours.
So, even the criminals.
Well, if there are state charges attached, it'll be longer than that because they're being held on state charges. So if we're talking about just being held on an ICE detainer, there's a 48-hour clock. I've been willing to say, I'll keep them here for 2 weeks if you need to, and I won't even charge you. Like, I want to help you out any way I can. But their own rules prevent them from housing for more than 48 hours.
And the ICE detainment would be that they are simply just there because they entered the country illegally. There was no
Correct.
Other crime associated with
I would say
them
all,
being there.
No, I would say all the time that there is some type of crime attached to it. No one's being arrested just for being illegal in the country. So there's always going to be some kind of crime attached to it. But then the ICE has a matrix where they say, okay, this crime we're going to hold on, this crime we're not. And as time has gone on, that list has become much smaller in what they can hold on.
I was going to say, what kind of crimes do they not hold on? Like, what should we be?
Are DUIs,
wow.
Domestic violence,
wow.
Some sex offenses, that like a misdemeanor range sex offenses. So it's got to be an aggravated felony for them to be serious about actually detaining.
Wow.
And if that in that 48-hour window, if they're actually going to detain, then they transport them down to Nevada where they have a private facility and an ICE facility down there. Going back to that memo a year ago, so basically I ended up saying, no, we're not working with the ICE. We're canceling the contract. So then a loan director from Salt Lake City office, not ICE from D.C. or a big national push, it's this one loan director from Salt Lake City office, put out a memo. It started circulating amongst our legislators, and it essentially blamed the sheriffs for the immigration problem. Well, the Sheriff's Association didn't like that, obviously,
right.
Because we've tried to work with them for years. We've tried to make it happen. And so within 2 weeks, we're in a meeting with his boss from D.C. He ended up withdrawing the memo. We had the governor come out. No, we're not a sanctuary state. We had immigration attorneys said, no, Utah's never been in a sanctuary state. So that big distinction is that we don't have policies that say local law enforcement can't work with ICE. So that memo got squashed. We're still trying to work with ICE. If ICE came to me and said, hey, you know, we want to work with you again, long-term housing, I would be absolutely open to it, but they got to get rid of their inspections. So I get inspected constantly by the state. I'm getting inspected by the U.S. Marshals. So here's another example is U.S. Marshals is a federal agency. ICE is a federal agency. We've worked with U.S. Marshals for years. Currently, I house about 50 or 60 of their inmates right now. They do their inspections, and we always play nice. So what I'm telling our federal delegation, the simple fix is just – change the ICE rules to what the U.S. Marshals rules mm-hmm. are, and we'll all play nice and things will be well, right? I want to help anywhere I can. If things do change in January of next year and we get a new administration that wants to really fight the illegal immigration, I'm willing to put boots on the ground to help with that. So,
yeah, yep. No, that I definitely appreciate your focus on that. So with the detainments, you're saying that, you know, even things like a DUI and certain sex crimes, ICE isn't holding or allowing holding for that. Aren't those also chargeable crimes at the state level? So
they
can
are.
We, like, why are we not charging them then at the
we
state
are.
Level? So
we are.
Okay.
We are. So when we're talking about ICE, we're talking about just the detainer. There's always going to be some kind of state charge attached, or there could be a serious federal charge attached. But again, so DUI, you're going to go to jail. You might be in there for 8 to 12 hours. A judge is going to look at the bail schedule and their matrix. And high probability, if it's your first offense DUI, you'll be out of jail in 8 to 10 hours after a state judge has already, you know, said you're out with this amount of bail, $10,000 or $5,000 or no bail attached at all. That's another issue is several years ago, about 5 years into it now, the state did the JRI legislation, which is Justice Reinitiative. I can't remember. It's an acronym, anyways. But what it did is it decriminalized a lot of the crimes, particularly felony possession of drugs, which would include your hard drugs, fentanyl, heroin, cocaine, methamphetamines. So all those went down to a Class A misdemeanor.
The state did that.
The state did that. So JRI was intended on focusing on more treatment and rehabilitation efforts. So they went ahead and did that, changed the law, but they didn't really have a lot of that infrastructure in place. So since then, so now we have a receiving center, we have more in-house drug treatment programs, which is good. That's a good part of JRI. Me personally, if we can find a way to put somebody back on the straight and narrow path and become successful in society, then I want that to happen, right? At the same token, I think that there are individuals that anytime they're not incarcerated, they're creating more victims. I've seen that. Mm-hmm. They're starting with misdemeanors, felonies, and next thing you know, they're getting booked in for killing somebody. I've seen that personally in my career. Some of the things that has affected, like our drug court program, we've been running that for 23 years now. Very successful when compared to private in-house treatment centers. Very rigorous rules and, you know, doing urine test daily, having people drop into your home or your work to make sure you're complying by the rules. But a lot of the incentives to get into that program have went away. Mm. So if you're second, third count of possession of a hard drug, you're going to pay a fine or you're going to spend 30 days in the county jail, if that. Or you can sign up to do a one-year very intense drug court program. So the incentive to get in a drug court has kind of gone away because, I can do 30 days in county or I can pay $800 in a fine
right.
and not jump through that hoop. So that's an issue that hopefully can be remedied. If you look on my website, so the washsheriff.net website, there's a felony release report. And I did that out of frustration. I know even some of our judges are frustrated. But right now the prison is, so anyways, that report, you can go in and see, you know, who the inmate was, what their charges are, what they were released on, and how long they spent in the jail, and which judge released them under what conditions. So an example I use is there was a lady that was booked in for homicide. So she killed somebody, period. And she got let out on a $10,000 bond, which means she had to come up with $1,000 if she with a bondsman company, and she got released on a homicide charge.
Wow.
That's a negative effect from JRI. Mm-hmm. So previous to JRI, if you killed somebody, you were going to stay in jail.
Yeah.
And if there was a chance you were going to get out of jail, it would be $1 million bond.
Right.
So that's just a real glaring in-your-face example of how JRI hasn't helped us.
Mm-hmm.
Another statistic between 2020 and 2022, assaults on police officers has literally doubled.
Wow.
So that's an indicator, but hey, you know, maybe we're letting the wrong people out of jail. You know, your low-end criminal isn't going to want to scrap with a cop with body armor and a gun and less lethal options, but it's happening. Mm-hmm. So that's another statistic that I can point to.
I've got to go back for 1 second about the ICE requirements. So you mentioned the, you know, 700 and something page requirements of like certain lotions, and they have to have a separate entrance. What is their motive? I mean, for any, I mean, we all know that government doesn't always make common sense decisions, but like, why on earth would they have all of these separate requirements, which essentially are more luxuries for people who are not even here legally? Why do they get luxuries on our dime?
Simply put, it's designed to fail, period.
Yes,
I mean, that's all there is to it. It was designed to fail from people that want to have our borders open.
Yes.
That's all there is to it.
Yeah.
So if we went to the U.S. Marshall standards, it would fix everything.
Right. So. And so also, and you've talked on this topic already a little bit, the drug task force. And again, this stems back to our open border under Biden, where we've had a 600%+ increase of opioids going across I-15. We've got a main highway right here through St. George and Washington County that the increase has been astronomical, right? In opioids and different drugs coming through. Maybe talk about that a little bit, the increases you've seen and things we're doing to address that.
So out of everything, I get asked this a lot, right? So are you seeing a bunch of illegals around town? No. Have they always been here? Yes. Mostly in the construction industry. They don't cause many problems. But there hasn't been a big influx where I can say, illegal immigrants are coming to Washington County in droves. No, I haven't seen that. What I have seen is the fentanyl coming through. So looking at some historical statistics through the Drug Task Force, 3-4 years ago, we might have gotten 200 to 400 fentanyl pills in an entire year. In 2023, we recovered 167,000 pills.
Jeez.
Which, you know, the thing with fentanyl, it's so basically China is shipping chemicals to Mexico. Why wouldn't somebody try to stop that? Second, super labs in Mexico are producing it, pressing it. They're trying to make them look like a legitimate prescription, the M30 pills. So most of them are blue with an M on one side and a 30 on the other. The issue is there's no quality control in super labs in Mexico. So the end user has no idea what they're ingesting. Some people say that that's part of the high is, hey, I'm risking death here, right? We're seeing, obviously, that's gone through the roof, you know, thousands and thousands of percentages higher than we've seen in years past. That effect is affecting overdoses, too. So if you take the pill and you don't know if it's 10% fentanyl or 60% fentanyl, it could be one pill that takes you out. It could be two pills that takes you out, right? As we speak, Washington City is on an overdose right now as we speak. So we're seeing them on a weekly basis, and all of my deputies and most police officers in the county are carrying two doses of Narcan on them, a nasal injection. A couple months ago, I had a couple of inmates that overdosed. One had to receive 4 doses of Narcan, the other one 6.
Wow.
My nursing staff thought they were dead initially when they saw them.
And don't you just love that was our current president's solution to this open border problem was, we just need to get more Narcan more readily available. Like, yeah, let's just slap some Band-Aids on there. Let's not stop the artery, the problem, right?
Yeah.
The influx. Just keep throwing Narcan at it.
If we're talking about drugs and illegal immigration, we just need to stick with policies that don't entice people to do that. So the solution to not using drugs is we need more Narcan. Are you fixing the problem? You're not. You're just, it's going to be an eternal problem if you do that.
Right.
If your policies, you know, you see Mayor Adams in New York City handing out prepaid Visa cards and calling for work permits for people that are legal. So do you think New York's ever going to solve that problem if they're just offering honey to the bear all the time?
Right.
So it's kind of interesting to see.
I hope they all flock to New York.
Well, it seems like they are. I think Utah's been lucky. There was one, and the Sheriff's Association addressed this directly with ICE. There was a busload of illegals that were dropped off in Salt Lake that came out of Denver. The second we found out about that, we were on the phone directly with ICE saying that's not going to happen in Utah. So
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I had heard is Salt Lake City is a sanctuary city? Is that true?
I don't know if they have policies, but if there's any city in the state that I would suspect would do that, it would be Salt Lake City, unfortunately, that we're seeing some of that. You know, not trying to solve the problem, just softening the blow to the problem. But it, at the end of the day, it enables the drug users. It enables illegal immigrants, right, to come in.
Right.
So if I was illegal in the country and I heard New York City was going to give me a $1,000 gift card and give me free housing and a nice hotel and give me food, I'm going to go to New York, right? So...
yeah, that, I think that's the root right there is we need to make sure in our policy that we are not making it a hospitable place for people right. to be here illegally, and especially those who are already committing other crimes here.
Correct.
So, correct. Yeah.
And you've seen in the national news that, you know, Venezuela and some of Cuba, some of those countries, they're basically opening their prisons and saying, go to the United States.
Wow.
So they're not sending us their best and the brightest.
Mm-hmm.
Again, legal immigration, great. We can screen them. We know who's coming in. I would like to see, again, that some expedited processes, but we know that we vetted that person. We know that they're going to be able to come into our country and produce for themselves and be a benefit to their community. It's the illegal immigration is the problem. Kind of switching gears, I wanted to touch base a little bit on some of my statutory obligations and some of the day-to-day things at the sheriff's office. So, again, I'm elected. A lot of people don't understand how big the sheriff's office is. We have 174 employees. The majority of those you never see because they help run the jail. We have three divisions. So the patrol division are the deputies you see out on the streets in the patrol trucks. A couple specialty units on our patrol side. We have three canines. Two are drug and patrol trained. We just had another one trained up that is specific to search and rescue. So cadaver and human scent dog, not a drug sniffing dog, but for helping to locate people for search and rescue operations.
Those canines are invaluable. Correct. I think they are just, I mean, especially when it comes to the drugs, like amazing that we have them.
Yeah. And the canine handlers themselves spend more time with the dog than they do their own families. So our canine handlers take the dogs home with them and then they bring them to work. They're training every week at least 12 hours. Their initial certification is 500 hours. They have to go through a rigorous testing and certification process every year. So it's a big deal. We also oversee a multi-agency SWAT team. So there's two teams in the county. St. George City has their own, and then we handle everything else in the county. We have Santa Clara Ivins, Hurricane City, and Washington City all participate in that. And then we're kind of lucky. We have a bomb squad, a certified, equipped bomb squad in Washington County. I happen to be a bomb tech for 16 years of my career. And we're the only squad south of Provo. So we handle the five southwest counties. So we know in Washington County that if we have an improvised explosive device or military ordnance or commercial explosives, that we have a solution very readily available. That's not something a typical firefighter or a law enforcement officer could handle without that specialized training equipment. The next division is our jail division, so they run everything housing. We house about 430 inmates, pretty consistent, sticking about 430. But if you think about the jail operations, we use inmate labor to do like laundry and cook food. During budget time last year, I calculated that our kitchen made 471,000 meals last year, so a lot of work.
Wow.
You know, religious and education services, rec time. We have a high school diploma program right now. We're working with Snow College right now to try and get some secondary education in as well. So, again, the goal, if we can get people on the straight and narrow and get them to be productive members of society, I want to support that any way I can. And then our third division is our support division. So they oversee... statutorily, we have to provide court security for the state courts. Unfortunately, they only reimburse me about a third of what it actually costs the county to do that. I've been kind of working on that angle to fix it, but nobody likes to just write more checks, right? They also oversee our work crews. So you'll see inmates picking up trash on the side of I-15 or helping clean the cemetery at the city, things like that. And then our transport division. So they basically all day long as they move inmates back and forth to court, or they'll go to Salt Lake and pick up inmates up there. So yeah, it's kind of some of the day-to-day operations.
Is the receiving center up and going?
It is going. So that's overseen.
Explain that a little bit more, because that's, I know, been a subject that people have really been questioning too.
So I think there's value in it. It's kind of new.
Out by Purgatory.
Yes, it's right next to the DMV and UDOT facility out there. But basically, if an officer makes an arrest on a minor offense, you know, trespassing or something of that nature, and they believe that the individual is committing the crimes because they're a drug addict or they're a mental health consumer, that instead of taking them to the jail, they have the option to take them to the receiving center. So essentially, the criminal charges will be hanging over their head. The receiving center will put them on a program, whether it's trying to get the right prescription medication or finding employment for them, getting them stabilized, right? They're calling a crisis. So this person is in bad shape, mental health, or detoxing from drugs or overdosing from drugs. And so they will stabilize them. They will put them on a path. And if they do not accomplish that path, then they refer them back to the prosecutor's office. So those original charges will be charged at that point. But right now, and talking to their director, they're seeing, you know, 10 to 12 a week maybe. I think they need to do a little bit better job at advertising, because it's not just law enforcement or public safety that can drop people off. Family members can take other family members there. 24 hours a day, they're open, you know, 24 hours.
So if someone has a family member that's, say, suicidal.
Yes.
Yep. They could go there.
Exactly.
To the receiving center.
Yep.
Or who's strung out on drugs.
Yep.
They could take them there instead of switch point.
Yeah, just know it's open. It's open to the community. It's a resource. You know, they're not going to charge you. It's all funded. And what that does, so even if it's 10 or 12 people a week, that's 10 or 12 people that I don't have to book in a jail. So the booking process takes about an hour for each individual, whether it's, you know, misdemeanor charges or felonies. But just that process is very time consuming and tedious. So even that 10 to 12 that don't come to the jail is helping me out.
Are there other places who have implemented this model that have seen a lot of success with it?
So we're the second one in the state. I believe the first one is up in Davis County, and they've been up and running for a couple of years now. And the feedback I get from the Sheriff Sparks up there is that it's a good program, that they've benefited from it.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So what else? Are there any other? I mean, we hit on a lot of the big concerns that I feel like I hear about in our county. Are there other things that you feel like need to be addressed, or that you have plans of doing things for in the county?
Yeah, I think, you know, I had a pretty long list when I first came in as sheriff, and I've checked just about every box off. A lot of that having to do with just keeping morale high at the office, making sure that our wages are in the market for Washington County. The commissioners have been really good. I can honestly say they've given me everything I've asked for. Of course, there's some back and forth there, right? Like, hey, I need this, but I'm going to do this, this, and this, or this is the need. But they've been really good. Right now, we're doing a jail expansion. So we talked about COVID, and my, you know, personal feeling is aligned with you on that freedom of choice for how, you know, your medical treatment is. And I know you're very vocal in that 2020-2021 era, but the county was open. Our commissioner signed a proclamation to keep Washington County open, to encourage businesses to stay open.
Right.
So I think we are lucky to have that. But one of the issues in the jail is if we get COVID in the jail, then we have to have some quarantine space. So we have liability on protecting inmates. So sometimes inmates will end up committing suicide in the jail. We have special clothing that they wear, so that I have to give them a blanket or I get sued. If they hang themselves with that blanket, I get sued. So with the COVID restriction, even though my personal feeling was that I didn't think it was that big of a deal, when I had it, I actually had like 3 days of a tickle in my throat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When I tested positive, I was kind of shocked, because it was that time we just, you know, we're hearing all these horror stories. And of course, it was real. People did die from it. But my personal experience is it wasn't that big of a deal. I would rather have those symptoms than a regular flu or cold. But the issue we had in the jail is, even though we house 430 inmates, we have about 500 beds, we needed entire sections to quarantine. And mm-hmm. then, so, okay, you're tested positive. You're going to go to this block for a little while. And then after 2 weeks, you're going to go into this block. And so we needed some wiggle room. We had to put some restrictions on there. So with that being said, we are doing an expansion now. We're going to add 64 new beds, but the space is going to be dedicated to individuals with mental health and drug detox. So we'll have classroom space, we'll have a medical office, we'll have a mental health office, and then individual housing for them in that section. So that's kind of our answer to if we get another COVID event, that's going to give us some more wiggle room to move people around. Right now, those individuals that we need to check on every 15 minutes or that medical is always seeing or that our licensed clinical social workers are always interviewing and dealing with, they're housed in booking, and we're just bursting at the seams in booking right now.
So I know a lot of the concern is being sued, liability. Mm-hmm. You hit on that. Would ultimately having a strong attorney general who you feel like would back you up in those circumstances, would that help us be able to better do the right thing? I mean, even back to the, you know, ICE and illegal immigration, yeah. and we're concerned about the ACLU and all of these people suing us. But if we have an attorney general who's like, no, we're just going to do the right thing and I'll have your back as long as you're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Does that alleviate some of the burden for you?
It would. So there's a little bit of difference there. So I inherited 3 lawsuits when I came in. They're usually, you know, complaining they didn't get enough medical attention or something like that. We do have nursing staff on 24/7, so it's we have emergency medical care. We're covered that way. But we are part of Utah Association of Counties and then USIP. So if we get sued, they provide us with an attorney that fights that at the local level, right? So if we're talking about the attorney general level, it's going to be he's fighting the federal government on federal government policy. So where they have overstepped, you've seen a lot of talk about the emissions requirements that's coming out, right? That's mm-hmm. pretty much impossible to reach.
Right.
If you look at the practicality of it, to meet those standards is impossible, right? And you talk about the infrastructure with e-vehicles and not enough charging stations and it's impossible to reach. So that's where the attorney general comes in and says, hey, federal government, you've overstepped. We're a sovereign state. We're going to fight this. And that's going to be more of the attorney general's focus.
Yeah.
More on the federal versus state or state versus federal issues.
And I think we're there when it comes to illegal immigration. If ICE is going to come in and the federal government is going to come in and tell us what lotion we have to provide people who are here illegally.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know why the attorney general wouldn't say, well, we're just going to do the right thing. We're going to prosecute these people. We're going to hold these people for as long as they need to be held. And so, we're not giving them special lotion.
So they are doing that at the state level, whether you're illegal or legal. If you're charged with a crime, you're going to, if it's a serious crime or a misdemeanor crime, you're going to be treated like anybody else in the system. Right. So when we're talking about the special lotion and can't lock them down, that's what affected the agreement with me and ICE for the long-term housing side of it. Again, I would love to work with them. I'd love for them to be reasonable. I'd love that their rules wouldn't put civil liability on me, right? So I would love to work with them. And I know, I work with our local FBI agents, DEA, HSI, ICE, and they're conservative folks. They are. They're frustrated. They're frustrated, but the problem is their bosses in D.C., right? They don't, we deal with land issues in the West that people from New Jersey can't understand. They don't understand why we can't, why not shut down 600 miles of trails in Moab? We're constantly fighting the federal government on them trying to, their solution for managing public lands in most cases is to close it off.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's amazing the effect and impact that the federal government, all the way in Washington, D.C. I mean, yes, our local elected officials are so, so important to hold that boundary and that line. But it's just amazing to see how from the Trump administration to the Biden administration, mm-hmm. how even all the way here in Washington County, how it's significantly affected us.
Yeah, the policies do affect the nation. So
Absolutely. Well, we just have 1 minute left.
Okay.
Thank you so much for all you do for our county and all of those who work in your department. You guys are phenomenal. I will give you the last minute to say anything you'd like to say.
Okay. I just appreciate you having me on. Again, I love opportunities to speak to the community and let them know. I think a lot of people, I mean, to be honest with you, I would say probably the majority of the citizens in the county don't understand the difference between the sheriff and the police departments.
Very true.
So if you think of it, so we cover 2,500 square miles of Washington County, every single inch of it. And about 50% of what the sheriff's deputies do is helping other agencies out, whether it's St. George City or Highway Patrol. If St. George City gets a lost child, it's like an all hands on deck. We get search and rescue there. We get air support now. By the way, DPS, phenomenal, getting that helicopter down here about a year and a half ago. It has saved us so much time in manpower and saved so many lives already. I just hope the state continues to fund that. It's a great resource to have in Southern Utah.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much for our service to Washington County, and you have our support. Like I was saying off air, everyone I've talked to just thinks you're phenomenal.
No, thank you.
So thanks again.
I still enjoy going to work every day too.
Thanks for being a part of the Michelle Tanner Podcast. Please like, follow, subscribe, and share. And always remember to keep exposing truth.
But I won't back down. No, I won't back down.
This has been a production from a podcast studio.